Welcome to the podcast, People of the Book. I'm your host, Meryl Ain. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We chat with authors and storytellers in thought-provoking and intimate interviews, all with a Jewish twist. On today's program, we're going to do things a little differently. I'm delighted to welcome Bela Lovins and Randy Brenowitz, who are going to chat with me about my new novel, Shadows We Carry, which will be published next week. Both Randy and Bela are active and valued members of my Facebook group, Jews Love to Read, and they've read an advanced reader copy of my new book. Bela was born and grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. Following undergraduate studies at Ithaca College and University of Massachusetts, she earned a master's degree in elementary education at Lesley College. She taught English as a second language before deciding to pursue an MSW degree in New York at Yeshiva University. In New York, she met and married her husband, Herb, and ultimately settled in Port Washington on Long Island. Bela has been involved in working in the Jewish community, both professionally and as a volunteer, for most of her life. Like her mother and grandmother before her, she is a member of Hadassah. It is under the influence of those two women that she developed her lifelong love of reading, which she joyfully shared with her two children and now with her four young grandchildren. Randy Brenowitz grew up in Brooklyn, New York. She holds a BS in history and education from Northeastern University and an MBA from Babson College. She spent many years as a human resources and organization development consultant in the high-tech industry. She then brought these skills into her work at the Ashman Family Jewish Community Center, where she held several senior staff positions. Randy has been active in the Jewish community ever since she was president of Brooklyn Region BBG in high school. She served in numerous leadership roles, including World Ort, Reconstructing Judaism, and various congregations and day schools. Randy has just been elected to her second term as the international president of the board of the Melton School for Adult Jewish Learning. She's an avid reader, mostly of historical fiction, which she considers akin to Midrash. Randy lives in Palo Alto, California, with her husband, writer and therapist, Dr. Marty Klein. So welcome, Randy and Bela. I'm so honored to have you here. I'm honored to have you as wonderful members of Jews Love to Read. And believe it or not, we've never met in person, but I feel like we know each other well and we're friends, and I'm hoping to meet Bela in person soon. Bela lives on Long Island, and with your many trips, I hope that we will also meet. So
absolutely.
I'm gonna let you take it away now.
What an introduction. It's really great, and we're so excited. I know I'm very excited for you to launch this new book. It's love the first book, The Takeaway Man, and Shadows We Carry is such a great follow up to it. And I can't imagine anyone doing a better job of being so thorough in tying up every single loose end from the first book.
Thank you. But you really, I mean, honestly, thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. But I think if people want to read it as a standalone, they can do that. I mean, I'd love for them to read The Takeaway Men first, but I really don't think you have to. Do you think so?
I would agree, Meryl. I read them both, of course, but one of the things I like about a series is when you can read each as a standalone. So I would recommend that if people want a treat, they should read them both. Why not? But they don't need to. The Takeaway Man certainly stands by itself, and you give enough of the background I also want to join with Bela in congratulating you on this exciting venture. And I was struck, and there, we're going to talk a lot about the book, but I was struck particularly by how well you brought us to the time and articulated the time for me, because that's the time I grew up. The sisters are 3 years older than I am. So I grew up when they grew up. And it at one point you had one of the characters went into the basement and was opening a closet. And I thought, oh yeah, that's where they store the suitcases. And then I laughed thinking not every family stores the suitcases there. And you then described the blue Samsonite suitcases. And I thought, okay. And over again, I had that. So it was, in addition to being a wonderful novel, it was really a visit to my childhood. And that was fun for me. You don't have to be in your 70s to enjoy the book. Younger people certainly would too. But but for those of us who grew up in that era, it really resonated even more, I think, a little. So congratulations.
Thank you, Randy.
I totally agree with Randy in terms of bringing us to that place, you know, our development years, I would say, developmental years. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, I also am a little bit younger than Branka and JoJo. I was in a junior high school when JFK died, not in high school, but not much, and not much difference in terms of the times and in terms of the events that take place during the story. It really was how I grew up, how I experienced high school and college, and it was wonderful to go back and experience that again, especially through the eyes of the two characters.
Well, thank you. And one of the reasons that, one of many reasons why I started where I did was because, 1968-69 were years of terrible, terrible political and cultural turmoil in this country. And I wanted it reflected, and we are not going to get political, but I also wanted to set one of the twins' experiences, who has an unplanned pregnancy, in the years before Roe v. Wade was passed by the Supreme Court in January 1973. So I wanted it. I wanted all those factors to be there, and I'm glad that it resonated with you, and I hope it will resonate for people of all ages. One of the reasons I wanted to write about it was a look back for those who experienced it, but also younger people who, the next generation, who didn't know what it was like. It was really a very hard fight for women's rights, and it's still going on. So I was wondering if there was anything in particular that resonated with you during that time period.
For me, it was Branka's journalism quest. I spent a lot of time being in meetings where I was the only woman in the room in the early days of my career. And it's so hard to give that feeling to the younger women who are coming up, who certainly have experienced other hurdles. I'm not saying life is easy for anybody these days, but that particular hurdle they don't necessarily have. Mm. And it was that spoke to me. I think you articulated it really well. And in many cases where people didn't mean harm, and there were certainly people who did, but in many cases where the men in her colleagues who didn't even mean harm, but they just didn't know how to be with her. And that spoke to me a lot. And her desire to break out and to do more than just the women's things and the cooking shows. This is a woman who didn't know how to cook, and they just immediately assumed she could do the cooking column. And nobody thought that was hot, you know.
Because that's what women stuck
with. Because that's what women were able to do. And it was only because the other guys couldn't make it because it was a Saturday that she got this big break. And that those kinds of things happened all the time. You know, it was a novel and it's fiction, but it resonated with real life over and over again. And that, I think, was a real taste of what the era was. I had occasion to go to a Little League game the other day, and my 12-year-old friend, there's a girl on the team. And afterwards I said to him, Yaniv, there's a girl on your team. And he says, yeah, like as if I said, there's a blonde on your team. There's a blue-eyed kid on your team. I mean, he just couldn't get what I was even asking him about. And of course, in our day, there's a woman journalist. Oh my God. So it was, I think that really spoke to the times and how much progress, at least in that area, has been made since then.
I agree with that. I think also the struggle is there. It's just taken a different direction, I believe. I mean, I know for my daughter and daughter-in-law, the choice of being with their young children, you know, staying home and doing that or working is, you know, partially a choice, but partially they feel they need to for financial reasons. And they find, you know, they're still in many ways, still the one that is relied on in their relationships more heavily to take care of children and the home, even though they share it and their husbands are great. They're certainly far more helpful than my husband was.
Absolutely.
Still, a lot of that burden still falls on their shoulders. And now they're expected to do the work outside the home as well, and to be able to handle both. So there's still that struggle going on. And I think that younger women might be surprised to learn that, for them, they may feel things and feel like, oh, this really hasn't changed that much. Yes, I can go into the workplace. That part is great. But in terms of my own personal struggle with it, it's still there, like JoJo. I mean, she still do those things. And I think that some younger women still feel that kind of struggle.
I think absolutely. You know, I recently reread The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, which was published in 1963, and which is credited as ushering in the second wave of feminism. And, you know, her thing was the malaise that has no name, that there were all these women, and she was really basing it on her friends and fellow alumni from Smith College, which I don't think was necessarily the norm, but many women felt that way. There were women who had to work for financial reasons, but her group did not. And she articulated this, you know, how it was just such drudgery and such a terrible thing to have to be home. But I think you're making an interesting point that this generation really has to readjust that thinking and that sharing, as they are, you know, for the most part, in the workplace now, doing the jobs that only men had 60 years ago. So that is really that's interesting.
You do bring up a good point, Bela, which is the the lean in, lean out type of thing, that it is now an expectation that you'll have a career and also keep a lovely home and raise 2.3 fabulous children and a dog,
especially a dog, at least one,
which requires more care than a baby sometimes, and I think that there's pressure now that we didn't face in some ways to be all of it, so somebody needs to write a novel about that, but that's not JoJo and Branka. Maybe they're children. I forget the name. Oh, I'm embarrassed. Wow. Maybe there's a novel in there, Meryl.
Yeah, I'd like to get on to some of the other things.
Yes, please.
I'm so fascinated with Father Stan. I love that character. I loved the conflict around it for Branka, and I loved his story, his backstory, which you said is from an actual person.
Yeah, it's loosely based on the story of a priest who was given for safekeeping, really, to a Catholic couple in Poland during the Holocaust, and they were murdered, and he was raised by this family, and he didn't always kind of wondered why, you know, he didn't look like the rest of the family. And he was raised in Poland. And I made my character come to the United States and become a very prominent priest. But that, you know, that's one of the themes that runs through the book, the shadows we carry. Honestly, I wanted the title to be The Weight of Genes, G-E-N-E-S. And my publisher just said, it sounds like a nonfiction book, but I, you know, there was that book by Rachel Kadish, The Weight of Ink. And I just thought The Weight of Genes was really what the point that I wanted to make, but everybody on her team loves Shadows We Carry. And now I actually like it. And I went to Yisker yesterday, and the rabbi actually incorporated, you know, Shadows We Carry. He said, we all, pardon, but we all have shadows we carry. So, you know, that I wanted to explore that through the various characters, through obviously Branka and Jojo, whose father was, you know, a Jewish Holocaust survivor, the mother who was a righteous Gentile who saved him, but and is practicing Judaism, but never officially converted, and through the son of the former Nazi, you know, is he responsible for the deeds of his father because he has his bloodlines? And of course, the priest, is the priest Catholic or is he Jewish? And you'll have to read the book to to get the answers to all those questions. But those are very important questions to me. And I think, you know, that today, with all this emphasis on DNA testing, it's really a question, you know, is it nature versus nurture? I mean, does it really matter what your DNA is? So is it the family that gave birth to you or the family that loved you? I mean, this has always been an issue for, you know, adoptive families, but now it's a big issue. And I think it's fascinating and I wanted to explore it.
And I like the way you had, I won't give it away, but I love the way you ended with him. I mean, you kept us on the edge of our seats, but I think you were true to his integrity, the way you built him.
Yeah, I felt I had you sure what was, I really wasn't sure as I was writing it, what was going to happen. But, you know, they say the characters start talking to you and telling you where they want to go. And, again, read the book and you'll find out what happens.
You'll find out.
Understand.
I was curious about why you had the mother never having converted. Why you chose to have that in the book.
I had that because the question of who is a Jew has fascinated me for a long time. And I remember when I was first married, we were at a wedding on Stuart's family side. And, you know, it was a Jewish wedding. The bride had a Jewish name. The bride was his cousin, second cousin. And the groom was Jewish and they got married under a chuppah. And, you know, we're at the reception and there was dancing and all of a sudden the band strikes up a polka. Well, I don't think that I've been at, even 50 years later, I've ever been at a Jewish wedding where they played a polka. So I just turned to my mother-in-law and I said, like, what's with the polka? And she says, well, you know, Jeanette is not really Jewish. So that was the bride's mother. And I don't know, that's just stuck in my head for all these years. But she made a Jewish home. She raised her children as Jews. And I mean, now I know that Reform and Reconstructionists consider the children Jewish if they have a parent who's Jewish and the children are being raised as Jewish. And obviously the Orthodox don't. The conservative movement is still, it doesn't, but I think they grapple with it as there's more than 70% intermarrying today. And it's just always been fascinating to me to ask the question, what is a Jew? Because in the book, Judy is really a very good Jew.
Yes.
But she's not a technical Jew. And I just wanted to throw that question out there for readers and groups to think about. I tried to throw it out in the takeaway, man. And, you know, I did about 80 virtual programs for the takeaway, man. And very few even discussed it. I think it's such an important question.
Oh, wow.
It is an important question. And it's so in character for, I forgot the husband's name, to Judy.
Aaron.
Not to, he was so good at putting everything under the rug.
Isn't that right?
Told her she was Jewish and that was it. That's it. He's done. But it's so interesting that he, you know, of all the things, he was so particular about everything else and about deal with what he had done or what he hadn't done, or, you know, so he just let it continue like that. He could have done something about it, and he
he could have. He could have. So you'll read the book and see what happens
with her. But I liked that you had the twins, because each of them could deal with those situations differently, and that was fun. To have them having grown up in the same household under the same shadows, and each of them dealing with them differently and coming out as different people, so that you could almost write two novels at once in some ways. Of course, you know, you had the relationship between the two of them, which is lovely and beautifully written, I thought. But it was nice to be able to have two siblings who each took a slightly different path, so that you could see how the same experience, how each of us could have the same experience and respond to it differently. And that, I thought, was fun to read.
And one of the reasons, which I, when I wrote the takeaway, man, I shared, was that I did twins because my husband is an identical twin. And I mean, now they don't, you can tell them apart, but for years they just looked the same. In fact, my brother-in-law was the best man at our wedding. And when he walked down the aisle, even though I made him wear a pink shirt, you know, in the 70s, people laughed because they looked so much like him. There were people who gave him envelopes at the wedding, because even though they are, so I always say they have the same container, but really different souls, different characters, different values. And I really thought that's why I thought the twins would be a good vehicle for the story.
You had experience.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a very good vehicle in both books. It was.
Yeah, I liked them.
Thank you. So do we want to talk about some of the other themes in the book, anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I think that, so the thing, a couple of the themes is so sadly, I'll say that, you know, so prescient that you wrote about these things and you didn't, the anti-Semitism, I think we were feeling for a while. So that's not so surprising, but the, you know, the whole abortion issue too, it's just, you know, like you just happened to write about that. And now
I wrote the first draft before Roe v. Wade was overturned. And then I actually had the first draft into my publisher with the author's notes where it said it became the law of the land in 1973. And I had to actually rewrite it. And that, that really was very troubling.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, you know, the anti-Semitism, I guess that, for our generation, I don't think that we ever can really feel comfortable you know, with everyone. No, I mean, I don't know. I personally, I know there are people who ignorant people who are anti-Semitic, and they always will be. And I can't prevent that from happening. But I feel like maybe my kids really didn't think that this was something they were going to experience firsthand. And I, you know, and I'm afraid that now it is.
So Bailey, you and I spoke about this briefly the other day when we were on the phone, and we had such different growing up experiences about it, because I knew it happened in the world, but it didn't happen where I lived. And so I had, I think, some of the same experiences that you're thinking maybe your kids had. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was happening out there, and out there was even parts of the US. I mean, you know, I knew that, but I lived in very, you know, I grew up in New York City, and even though I lived in Boston, I lived in the Boston suburbs that were perfectly welcoming to Jewish communities. And then I moved to the Bay Area of California. I live in places that are very welcoming and agreeable to having large Jewish communities, and they're happy that we're here for the most part. But these days, I think it is so much more rampant in the last 15 years, perhaps, that you can't avoid it anymore. And it it's such a part of what's happening in this country. And I know we aren't to get political, but I think this is a big piece of what's happening right now in the US. And so having the, again, the experience of what was happening in Fatherland Gardens, what a name.
That's based on a real community called German Gardens.
Oh, I didn't know that. Finish. Oh my God.
I'll tell you about that. Finish what you're saying. Go ahead.
But so that experience, which I think if I had read this book 10 or 15 years ago, I would have thought, oh yeah, that's a nice little historical blip, like the blue Samsonite luggage. But now it's Pittsburgh and it's Charlotte and it's next door. And so it really was frightening in a way that, again, I don't think it would have been had I read this book, had you written it and had I read it 10 or 15 years ago. So it's a little scary. It's actually very scary.
So can you tell us about the historical?
I want to know.
It's a Merrill, because
I agree with you. And I just think in the last few years, it's really escalated. I don't have the report in front of me. I should have had it. But I mean, the reports are that it's really escalated exponentially. I don't remember the exact percentages, but it's way more. Mm. It was way more in 22 than it was previously. So I think that's a problem. So another little historical fact that I became aware of in researching was that there was a community in Yaphank, you know where Yaphank is, Bela and Randy, it's all the way out in Suffolk County.
Okay.
German Gardens. And you needed, and this is in my notes at the end, you actually needed until 2017, you needed proof of German ancestry to move in there. And it prior to the US entering the World War II in 1941, there were Nazi street names. The Hitler Strasse was the main road there. People displayed swastikas, but the really heinous thing about it was that there was a German youth camp which indoctrinated American kids into being good Nazis. And actually there was a play that was on Off-Broadway. And again, I wrote the book before I knew about the play or anything. Mm-hmm. Was already being published. It was called Camp Siegfried by Bess Wahl. And it ran, I don't know, a little less than 2 months, about this camp. And the play was about two young people who fell in love, and the Nazi leaders were trying to encourage it because they wanted them to get married and breed more Nazis. So this is you know, deeply rooted. I mean, there were also Nazi cells in Lindenhurst. You know, so it is on Long Island, and you never heard about it. And I'm very frightened about this whole explosion of neo-Nazism, because I remember, do you remember in the 70s with the whole issue about the march in Skokie, you know?
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, so that was, I think, in the late 70s. And, you know, we really haven't heard about it that much, but it seems like there is a renaissance, unfortunately, of it now. And I'm not exactly sure why, but it's really very, very frightening. I think it's something that, you know, a survivor like Aaron lived with, because he experienced it. But we, you know, and I grew up in Queens, which was probably similar,
right? Yes. But
you grew up in Brooklyn, and you know, my mother had grown up in a small New Jersey town with very few Jews. And she told me she was playing with her friend once, and her friend said, you know, you killed Christ. And my mother said, no, I didn't. And she started crying. I mean, she didn't know what she was talking about. And the girl said, oh, okay, I believe you. And then they went back to play. But I think that was one reason why my parents were determined to move to a neighborhood that had a big Jewish population. So where I grew up, it was very few Protestants. It was, you were either Jewish or Catholic. It was about half and half, and we all got along beautifully, and there was no anti-Semitism, at least that I was aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, which is what Randy was referring to, and we always experienced it somehow, some way. We ignored a lot of it. We just, you know, put it down to people's not knowing. Mm-hmm. Or understanding us, but there were always people who said something about like dirty Jews, or used the word kike, or said things. It just, you would just run across them. It wasn't like an everyday occurrence, but it was around enough for us to understand that there were people who didn't like us just because of who we were. And I, you know, I think it does, you know, the response to that, at least, you know, from my family and from my, you know, who are the people that I grew up with, was created liberal Jewish communities, because we understood other people's pain and suffering, and we wanted to help them, you know, in the ways that we were helped, and then the ways that we, you know, became, you know, able to do the things that we do. And so I just think that's what our response was. Our response was, well, we can make the world better, and we can do this in a better way. And so we ignore those people and go on and try to help other people that we see have that struggle as well. And, you know, I don't really know what else you can do about it, but I do think, Meryl, that part of what brings it up now and allows it to thrive is the internet. I'm sorry to say, you know, through all the things of the internet, there's also that negative part of it. And there's that underworld of people who never had a place to express all the negative things, have a platform for doing that. And that's very unfortunate.
That and we hear about it. I mean, we had to hear about Skokie on the 6 o'clock news or the 11 o'clock news, but when Skokie was happening, I was already asleep by the 11 o'clock news.
There was no cable.
There was no cable. There was no 24-hour news. There was no internet. So Skokie happened. It was a very big deal in the Jewish community. We heard about it from on the pulpit, and we heard about it on the 6 o'clock news, and we heard about it in the New York Times. But then it was done. There weren't millions of articles happening about it. So when Pittsburgh happened, the shooting of the Pittsburgh synagogue, just in, I think 2018 or 19, I can't remember exactly, that we heard about every single minute. I mean, that was on cable 24 hours. And because I'm involved in, as both of you are in the Jewish community, it was coming out in every Jewish press and they're all on the internet. I mean, I don't usually read the Pittsburgh Jewish news, but of course I was, you know, and it was there on the internet. And so you heard about this every minute. And so it kept top of mind. And I think that just encouraged other people it encouraged us as a Jewish community to come together. I mean, I went to synagogue that following weekend and, you know, the sanctuary was full. And I don't know about your synagogues, but my synagogue's not always so full on a Saturday morning, but it was full. And that was good, but it also, it gave motivation and legitimacy to somebody in some other community who was thinking about shooting up their synagogue. And I think the explosion of social media, which has some wonderful things. I mean, I'm a big social media person, as Meryl knows, but I think that
I met you guys through social media. So
exactly. I mean, here we are. So, but it's, there's that big downside to it. That's very, very scary. But interestingly enough, back to your book, Meryl, all of this was happening right after the war, after they knew what horrible things could happen if you allowed this to go on, and without the internet, and it was still this huge thing. I mean, the press was all there. I mean, when Branca's boss sent her, he didn't expect it to be this big deal. He was sending her on this little assignment, you know, go cover this. And it turned out that, you know, all of the press was there and it was a big deal. So even then it was, they were trying to make it a big deal at least.
Well, you know, it was Sunday, so there wasn't that much going on. I think that was, you know, actually why she got sent, but yeah.
But I do, you know, it's interesting. You're the what happens in the book, I think, is of interest to readers now because of how it was handled and where that news traveled to versus what happens today when something like that occurs. And so I think it's interesting and it puts it in some historical perspective for people to understand really, you know, what the world was like and how controversial issues were handled then as compared to now. And I, you know, that's what I think we all love about historical novels anyway, is that we get to look at a different time period and how things have changed, you know, for the better and sometimes for the worse. And, you know, we get to compare those things. And so I appreciate people like you, Meryl, who do that research, you know, that understand, even though it's, you know, in part, it's a time that we experienced, but we didn't, you know, look to research the depths of it the way that you did. And I appreciate being able to read a book that has that history in it for us to learn from.
Thank you so much.
I also thought I didn't like that it happened, but I liked the way you articulated the fact that the U.S., even the U.S., which we think of as such a good hero in the era of World War II, was not so interested in finding and persecuting Nazis who had made it to the US and were living, you know, living under the radar. And that, I think that's something that not everybody knows. And certainly I think most of your non-Jewish readers wouldn't necessarily know was going on at the time. And that, and it wasn't, you didn't make a whole big deal about it, but it's in there nicely. And I think that that's a big important thing that, that the issue of communism versus Nazism after the war, and how one took over from the other. And I, I just like that that got mentioned and got consideration in the book.
Thank you. And it really wasn't until the, you know, the late 1970s, due to the efforts of Elizabeth, Representative Holtzman. Elizabeth Holtzman, and mainly her, but others as well, where the OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, was created, which was in part of the United States Department of Justice. And then there was a whole, you know, protocol and method for bringing former Nazis to justice. But, you know, we're talking about more than 30 years after the war was over. And the dirty little secret is that the United States actually invited top scientists to come and to work in at Los Alamos, and in the space program, and they just, you know, they lived in plain sight, and they just looked away, because, as you said, Randy, the whole emphasis was on communism. The minute the war was over, you know, the Nazis were defeated, and then it was all about communism. So I think our time is drawing to a close. Does anybody have anything else you would like to say or add to our such a wonderful conversation? I just knew that it would be. Thank you.
Thank you. And Meryl, I do want to say I'm an avid listener of your podcast. I know Bela is too. And I was just looking the other day when I was wanting to load my Kindle. So many of the books on my to-be-read list are books that I come home, because I tend to listen in my car. So I come home, though, and I write that quickly, the books that I've been introduced to on your podcast. So you're with me even when I'm not listening, because many of the books I'm reading come to me through that. So I wanted to thank you for letting me be part of it.
Thank you.
And I agree. And I love listening to your podcast, because I think you're a wonderful, you have great interviewing skills. And I really love to listen. You ask questions that I wouldn't have thought of, and they're really interesting. And you go down interesting pathways with all your authors. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And this is actually a lifelong dream of mine. When I was a kid and I saw Barbara Walters, she was the only one. And who else could be Barbara Walters? But I always wanted to have a talk show. So now I have a podcast. okay, so thank you.
Are we going to see Jojo and Branka again? Or are they done?
I feel like I'm done with them, but you know, I'm always open to the influence of readers. I was not done when I finished the first book. As a matter of fact, I really didn't think it was over, and I shared everything with my husband, Stuart, and when I got to that part, he said, "That's it, that's the end of the book." And I said, "No." And he said, "That's the end of the book." And, you know, I was happy to be finished with it. So I okay. But that was, I got comments from many readers. I mean, a number of them asked for a sequel, but a few of them were like, "Why did you end it there? It wasn't finished." So I felt that I had to write it. And I did have much more to say about them. Do I have more to say about them now? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see. So, the book will be out on April 25th, and I want to thank Randy Brenowitz and Bela Lovins, and I want to thank our executive producer, Pam Stack. People of the Book is a copyrighted presentation of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Please visit us and like our Facebook page, People of the Book. I'm your host, Meryl Ain, the author of The Takeaway Man. The sequel, Shadows We Carry, will be published on April 25th and is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. For more information about my books and writing, visit me at merylain.com. I also hope you'll join me for my virtual launch party this Monday night, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The links are on Facebook and on my website. Until next time, please join us on Facebook at Jews Love to Read and read a good book.